Good morning, everyone. I'm Jane Bowers, excuse me, with a little frog in my throat this morning. And I am the Provost and Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs at John Jay College. I'm so delighted to welcome all of you today to the 11th annual John Jay Harry Frank Guggenheim Symposium on Crime in America. It's an honor to have with us as our special guest Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson of Gary, Indiana. And on his way, we understand, through the tunnel, which if you know Manhattan, you know is a dicey proposition, through the tunnel from Newark, Mayor Roz Baraka, not here yet, but will be here. I bring you greetings this morning from President Jeremy Travis. He couldn't be here because of a scheduling conflict, but as some of you know, he will be here at lunchtime and throughout the conference. It's no coincidence that John Jay College is the host and sponsor of this event. Most of you will already be aware, and I see friends in the audience who know John Jay's story very well. Most of you will already be aware that John Jay is the preeminent international leader in educating for justice, offering a rich liberal arts and professional curriculum that prepares our 15,000 undergraduate and graduate students from more than 130 nations to serve the public interest as ethical leaders and engaged citizens. What you might not know is that John Jay has the most diverse student body among the City University of New York's senior colleges. As a federally designated Hispanic-serving institution, nearly two-fifths of our students self-identify as Hispanic. In fact, this is the largest Hispanic student population of any four-year college in the Northeast, and we're very proud of this. Our faculty, many of them known to you, are regularly honored for their scholarship, teaching, mentoring, and other professional achievements. We boast three Pulitzer Prize winners on our faculty, one a journalist and the other two book authors, and recipients of the Stockholm Prize in Criminology and the White House Presidential Award for Excellence in Science, Mathematics, and Engineering Mentoring, among many other honors and awards. John Jay faculty are or have been presidents of the American Anthropological Association, the Academy of Criminal Justice Sciences, the American Society of Criminology, and the American Psychology and Law Society. An important dimension of our work at John Jay is promoting and encouraging informed public debate on the justice challenges facing our society. That is the central mission of our Center on Media, Crime, and Justice, so ably led by Steve Handelman, which for nearly a decade has brought journalists and editors together with scholars, policymakers, and practitioners for frank discussions about emerging topics of the day and a search for solutions. Our annual Harry Frank Guggenheim conferences are among the most important examples of the center's mission. They occupy a unique place in the nation's criminal justice calendar. And they are critical to the role we play as educators, both in New York and the country at large. So I want to express once again, in the name of all of us at the John Jay College community, our deep appreciation to the Harry Frank Guggenheim Foundation for its continued support, as well as to our other sponsors this year, the Pew Public Safety Performance Project and the Quattron Center for the Fair Administration of Justice. I would now like to turn the microphone over to Steve Handelman, the director of the Center on Media, Crime, and Justice, who will introduce our program. I'm very sorry that I will have to excuse myself for yet another meeting, but I wish all of you a stimulating and thought-provoking conference. Thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So our numbers look a little spare this morning, and there's pretty good reason for that. We've got folks on their way, stuck in places like Syracuse. As you heard, the Mayor Baraka of Newark is on his way. He doesn't have a weather problem. He's got a traffic problem. One of the problems of organizing these events in February is, February. There's no snow this time, but there's lots of wind, and we have some changes in our schedule, which I'll talk to you about as we go on through the day and tomorrow. But I want to welcome all of you. I saw a lot of you last night who are our fellows, and they're really the core of what we do. So those of you who are not among our journalist fellows will, I think, should know and would like to know that who our very impressive group this year is. We have 21 from all around the country, from as far away as Hawaii and as close as Brooklyn. So I'd like them to stand just for a moment just to be recognized. Just give them a quick hand. It'll be the only applause they'll get during the conference. And again, I want to repeat and echo Jane's appreciation and thanks to the Harry Frank Guggenheim Foundation. Without them, this couldn't be possible. They've been stalwart supporters of what we do every year, and although I know that they don't always like publicly, they're a bit shy, but I'd like to recognize Joel Wallman in particular from their foundation. Joel, can you stand up and receive our heartfelt thanks? Well, I don't know. I mean, you do a song and dance if you'd like. We can get you up here later. Also, not here yet, but we have Adam Gelb of the Pew Public Safety Performance Project and John Holloway of the Quatron Center for the Fair Administration of Justice, who are also our co-sponsors for panels during the symposium. I told those of you who are fellows a little bit about the your program. It's all in your program brochure. It's a great one. I know people never read program brochures until they go home and then try to remember what it was they said. But it's a pretty clear, it's a packed schedule this week. We will try to give you time for breaks and question answers during the different panels. But we're going to work you pretty hard, as I warned you last night. All of this is on the record. All of our panelists and speakers know that, and we're also podcasting through here, and the podcast of each panel will be posted on our site, the Crime Report, in about a couple of weeks as soon as they're ready. We're also videoing the opening keynote sessions of the two mayors this morning and tomorrow's keynote, and they also will be posted within about 2 or 3 weeks on our site. I'll let you know by email. We'll let you know by email when that happens. I already read you our the Wi-Fi passwords and usernames. There's a hashtag as well, so you can follow us on Twitter. And that is in your program, which I don't have at the moment. But I can. Surprisingly, it's called Crime in America. So let me get very quickly to the heart of this week's program, and there will be people coming in over the course of the morning, so I hope you won't be disturbed by it. So this past year has been a remarkable year in criminal justice issues, as I don't probably need to tell the journalists and the specialists who are here. We've seen a rise, again, officer-involved shootings in the wake of Ferguson. We've seen number of serial shootings and active shooting incidents. We'll be talking about that a bit this week. And we've seen a spike in crime in some of the major cities around the country, extraordinarily and surprisingly after more than a decade, two decades of crime drops and crime declines. Whether that means anything particularly in the long run is still an open question. The spike still comes from a very, very low base. But on the plus side, we've seen a task force report on 21st century policing, which the president commissioned, which is potentially the beginning of a change in policing culture and police behavior around the country. We've seen real discussions for the first time in a long time about changing our approach to incarceration. Congress now actively debating a sentencing reform bill at the federal level. We've seen, as you'll see and hear this week, the states actively engaging in efforts to reform and revise sentencing in many ways, in many cases ahead of what the federal government is doing. And we've also seen, perhaps possibly most remarkably, a real bipartisan approach to a recognition, first of all, that it's time for serious and genuine justice reform, and a commitment to going ahead with it. Now, that's come in fits and starts, and of course, we're in the midst of midway through an election campaign cycle this year, which is interesting for a lot of reasons, but among them is the fact that crime has again appeared on the agenda for the first time in a long time in the nation's politics. After, in the 90s, tough on crime rhetoric just dominated everything, and this time people are seriously talking about a lot of issues, about change, about reform, and of course some of the new issues that have come up, new problems that have come up, like the so-called supposed heroin epidemic, an opioid epidemic that's suddenly hit the country, but as we know, in many parts of the country already, it's been a problem for years and years and years, and it's now becoming recognized for a lot of reasons that we won't go into now, but we'll certainly touch on during the course of the conference. So this is the context and the parameters of why we're here today, what we're discussing today and tomorrow. And of course, the press has been a central figure, a central player in all of these issues, and in many ways a critical player. Ted Guest from the Criminal Justice Journalist and our partner in the Crime Report has again done a wonderful annual review of criminal justice coverage over the year. And he's noted, as we all have, that we've now got some competitors in the field who are non-traditional journalists, not even traditional online journalists, but we've got folks like John Oliver, we've got Making a Murder, Netflix, we've got all sorts of new voices and new approaches to covering issues of criminal justice. And that mix has really made this an exciting year to come in terms of justice issues. And we hope, holding this in February, despite the fact that it's probably the worst month in terms of weather, it's a good month to look ahead as we move into the final stages of the campaign cycle. So without further ado, I want to bring our panelists up to our to the stage, so to speak. We'll start, Mayor Baraka, I think, will be here at some point midway through. I think he's almost here. And let me start by introducing Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson. When Mayor Baraka comes, I'll talk about him. But I was awed this morning to realize that Mayor Freeman Wilson is in the midst of planning her State of the City address. She's an old pro at it, obviously. This is her second term. We're really honored that you've taken the time out of such an important political obligation to come here with us. As I began to say, that Mayor Wilson has been the mayor of Gary, Indiana. It's her second term, and she is a formidable presence, really, on the landscape of municipal politics and American mayors. Not only is she the first woman to lead the Steel City, but she's the first African-American female mayor in the state of Indiana, ever. And she comes from a criminal justice background, and she's been associated with John Jay for quite a while. She served as Indiana Attorney General, Director of the Indiana Civil Rights Commission. She's been presiding judge of Gary City Court. And she also was a leader of the National Drug Court Movement, as CEO of the National Association of Drug Court Professionals. And she currently serves as chair of the U.S. Conference of Mayors Committee, Mayors and Police Chiefs on Community Policing, which she did for the task force, as well as the Standing Committee on Criminal Justice. So we're really honored to have her with us for the time that she's able to come. To our moderator, I'm particularly delighted to introduce to you Neil Barsky, who will be facilitating a conversation between Mayor Freeman Wilson and Mayor Baraka, is chair and founder of the Marshall Project, which was born really just over a year ago and has already made a splash on the news landscape. One of the Marshall Project's best reporters is a fellow, Marie Sharma, and they also are responsible for this year's John Jay Prize for Excellence in Criminal Justice Journalism, which we will honor tonight. And one of their reporters has won the prize, Beth Schwartzoffel. I don't think she's here at the moment yet, but you'll see her tonight. And they've done some superb investigative work. That's the mayor. Excellent. Great. Welcome, Mayor Barker. I was just... So just completing my intro to Neil, he has a background in journalism where he did award-winning work for the New York Daily News and the Wall Street Journal, and then he crossed the bridge to Wall Street itself, where he enjoyed similar success in building two hedge fund businesses. And one of the things to know about Neil is that he's a film producer. Some of you may have seen his critically acclaimed commentary, Coke, about our former mayor, which aired nationally on PBS's POV series. Let me quickly turn to Mayor Baraka, who is now with us. Mayor Baraka has been mayor of Newark since 2014. His family has lived in the city for more than 70 years, and he has been received really glowing reviews for the work he's done so far in addressing the problems of one of America's most problem-prone cities in Newark, just across the river. Among his achievements, he even had a glowing review from the New York Times, which is saying something. And some of his achievements so far have been creation of the Newark's first ever police civilian complaint review board, the unification of the police and fire departments under a single Department of Public Safety. That was this year. And a public safety initiative called Occupy the Block, which involves a collaborative effort between city officials and local residents to disrupt criminal activities on high crime blocks. And I'm sure he's going to tell us more about that today. Some other noteworthy items in his bio. His father, the late Amiri Baraka, was a legendary poet and playwright, who some of you may know. His mother, Amina Baraka, is herself a renowned poet and also a published author. And his latest work, Black Girls Learn Love Hard, is dedicated to his late sister, Shani Baraka. So welcome to all our panelists, and Neil, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Steve. Welcome, everybody. It is true that, as Steve says, the last year has been pretty monumental in the area of crime. We call it criminal justice, but I think Steve actually may have understated it. But it bears noting that the crime report and this very symposium has been going on for a long time, 11 years, I think, well before the Marshall Project ever dreamed of criminal justice and, as an issue. And they've been... they've embraced us as partners often, and we're very appreciative. In fact, 2 years ago, to this day, we announced that Bill Keller was joining us as editor, and it happened to be the evening of the dinner for the fellowship, and Jeremy Travis, very graciously, I happened to be there, introduced me, and I spoke a little, and maybe some people were in the audience, and I was besieged by friends and helpers, including Beth, who is an award winner tonight, who wanted to work with the Marshall Project, including people who are advocates, and so this community, there's Beth right now. Sorry, Beth. Just coincidence. So 2 years ago, the keynote speaker at the dinner was Piper Kernan. And I don't know, this is, seems like ancient history, but at that moment, Orange is the New Black was sort of this cultural phenomenon which gave America, mainstream America, for the first time some insight into what it was like inside a woman's prison. And it was a very, it actually, even though it's entertainment, it was a very serious look. And the new Jim Crow, which I suspect most people in this room have read and know, had only been out for a couple of years, and it was only getting momentum. And if you fast forward to today, as Steve said, we've had a number of things, phenomena, that I think we could never have anticipated. The President of the United States has visited a federal prison. That had never happened before. He spoke about Black Lives Matter, which is a very grassroots movement that sprung from, as Steve mentioned again, police abuse and shootings in cities around the country. The Koch brothers, sort of, to many people, the embodiment of corporate power, have embraced criminal justice reform, as have other people across the political spectrum. Hillary Clinton, whose husband presided over the 94 crime bill, which most people, or many people in the criminal justice world, would see as a setback, has called for an end of mass incarceration. Bernie Sanders, obviously, is vocal. And even the Republican Party, before the dialogue sort of went off the rails, was starting to speak about this issue in an intelligent way, solutions-oriented, maybe less fear-mongering that we're all accustomed to. But when we started the Marshall Project 2 years ago, when we had the concept, there were approximately 2.25 million people behind bars in America. Today, there are approximately 2.25 million people behind bars in America. So notwithstanding all of the consciousness raising and elevation of this issue to one of national interest and hopefully urgency, real change is very hard if lowering the incarceration rate is your goal. I'm not saying it's everybody's goal. And so I'm very interested in the politics of criminal justice. And we have two mayors here from Gary, Indiana, is a city of less than 100,000 people, I believe. I think Newark is about 250,000 people. So these are small, mid-sized cities, urban, in post-industrial, who are wrestling with everything. And I want to give them a real wide berth and let them speak at some length about their own cities. But overridingly, I'm most interested in the contrast between dealing with crime and dealing with justice as a city mayor, where you have crime as a reality in the lives of your citizens and the relationship with the police is also a reality. And as we go forward, I hope we can, you know, peel the onion back a little and see how, as a mayor, as a leader, you navigate that issue. But I want to just open it up to Mayor Baraka first, going alphabetical. And so take 10 or 15 minutes and give us a little bit of overview of your own city, the issues, the pressing issues, and then I will drill down after Mayor Freeman Wilson.
You can use the podium if you want, or you can
say I'm fine. Yep. Good morning. Thank you for having me here this morning. We actually were talking about issues similar to this last night at a town hall meeting in Newark, amongst other things. Of course, crime and public safety and police accountability always comes up in our discussions from residents. Newark is a city of about 300,000 people, kind of a post-industrial, you know, this city has always been a city of immigrants and people who came up from the South looking for opportunity. You know, after World War II, they were kind of isolated or redlined, I should say, in the city where they were creating opportunities for people to move to the suburbs, and they built all these throughways or roadways, 280, 109, and 78 began to be created to allow people to live in the suburbs and work in the city at the same time, which helped to take a large amount of wealth out of the city, and it's been that way since. It's probably the epitome of most American cities like that, the same way as a great book called The Crabgrass Frontier that talks very clearly about, post-World War II and how most of these cities are in the conditions they're in because, the federal government began to subsidize suburban growth at the expense of cities that have never recovered. I mean, most people think that rebellion and civil unrest caused people to leave the city. That was probably the last group of people that left the town. When those things happened, the population of the city changed, but the power of the city remained the same. The complexion of it remained the same. And I'm saying that just to allow a backdrop for all of this, because at that point, the police department remained majority white, male, and the citizens became increasingly more African-American and Latino at the time. That has probably remained for a long time, and then probably in the last, 15 years or so, the police department began to change its demographic, and we have gotten more black and Latino police officers, but the leadership at the top invariably remains the same. So we're still trying to tackle those problems to begin to infiltrate or integrate the upper level of the police department. There's usually high-level, minorities at the top or African-Americans at the top, and then everybody else is at the bottom because mayors have come in and appointed African-American leadership and chief positions and positions of the director. But everybody else under that in leadership positions remain majority white. And that is a problem that we have to begin to tackle in the city. Most of those police officers do not live in the city. There is a law that says that they have to live in there for the first year. After that, they don't have to live in there anymore. It's a huge tax burden on the town. I mean, as a matter of fact, the police and fire are the greatest costs of the municipality. overall, and that money does not stay in our community at all, for the most part. So that has a serious and deleterious effect on the tax base in our community. We have tried to push statewide ordinances, a legislation to kind of reverse that, but it's always been vetoed by this present governor. Hopefully, when we get a new governor, we'll be able to try to affect of that. Because of the poverty that exists in the city, for the last 50 years, you would say 33% of the people in the city of Newark live in a serious level of poverty. The unemployment rate has been higher than the state and the federal rate for the last five decades. We have been pushing that number down as desperately as we can, but chronic unemployment and generational unemployment kind of remains the same. Newark lost about 60,000 jobs during a recession. We only recovered about 30,000 of those jobs. So we are working to try to restore that. But as a result, you have high levels of crime and violence in the city. Like most cities, it goes up and down, up and down, up and down. One year it looks promising. The next year we lose ground, and it goes back and forth from that. You get support from the state police, the federal government. And so what happens is you create almost a police kind of state where you know, we're looking for the police for security and safety. And most other communities look for jobs and education for security and safety. We actually look for the police. It's a kind of dichotomous relationship because we want the police to come and make our communities safe. When we don't see the police, people get upset. They say there's no police in our community. When you go to suburban communities, when they see the police, everybody pull over because they want to know why the police are here. In Newark, they actually reverse. They call elected officials and say there's no cops on my block. But then that relationship between the police and the community becomes strained because there are always incidents of police misconduct, over aggressiveness, stop and frisk, all of these things take place. And so it creates this kind of double-edged sword for us. And we have to navigate between trying to make the community safe and make sure that there's constitutional policing at the same time. We organized the Civilian Complaint Review Board, which I think is probably one of the most, which is one of the strongest ones, I think, in the country. It's not completely passed yet. It has to go through two more readings of the city council. There's already a considerable amount of backlash. We have appointed a civilian lawyer to be in charge of this, the internal affairs, to run internal affairs. So we're getting some pushback from that. We are holding community or civilian comstats, not just police comstats. We're holding community comstats in the neighborhood so community can see what's going on in the police department and make it more transparent. And we have what was called Occupy the Blocks, where police officers, as well as sanitation, code enforcement, fire, health department, everybody, we picked some of the most egregious and dangerous areas of the city, and we go there and we knock on doors, we talk to people, we abate issues from abandoned housing to illegal dumping to code enforcement on stores to slumlord kind of things. We do all of those things, and we allow the police to talk to residents and see them in a different light other than just arresting people. We try to create a relationship between the police and the community. And finally, we have following My Brother's Keeper, which was the president's kind of initiative. We do these cops and kids programs where police officers get the opportunity to talk to the young men in the community about really serious issues that they face when they encounter police officers on the street, the stereotypes that they feel about young African-American boys in the street and vice versa, and what they feel about police officers and how that kind of narrative can be destroyed. So this is just a few things that we are trying to do to ease or change the relationship between the police and the community. And it's my belief that changing that relationship will help reduce crime. And I think that this narrative that if you kind of monitor the police, you handcuff them and don't allow them to do their job, and so crime rises, I think that that is a misnomer, and that's in fact incorrect. I think the actual reverse is true, that if the people in the community actually trust and favor and partner with the police officers in their neighborhoods, that they begin to have a better relationship with them, and it helps them solve some of the issues of crime and violence and other issues that take place in a community. When people believe that the police officers are there as an appendage of the community and not there to kind of occupy the community, then I think it'll change a lot of things, the trajectory of the way things are going in these neighborhoods. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Mayor Freeman Wilson, and I will open up for some questions.
First of all, good morning to everyone, and it is my honor to serve on this panel. And thanks to the John Jay College for this symposium. When I think about something that mayors talk about very often, criminal justice reform, public safety, I always look at it from the perspective of community restoration, because from my perspective, I think that how you look at something matters because it impacts the way that you address it. In the 1920s and 30s, after being established by the United States Steel Corporation, Gary was called the Magic City. It's called the Magic City because of exponential growth. The population reached 178,000 people. We currently have just over 80,000 people. And if you look at the census, it would say just under 80,000, but we know because of some independent verification factors that it's more than 80,000. And so we have all of the issues that are associated with a very disorderly disorderly departure. Abandoned houses, vacant land, very high poverty rate, and crime. A very high unemployment rate. The state of Indiana Bureau of Labor Statistics lists our unemployment as, I believe it's 10%, which we all know to be abjectly untrue. Generally, I call it a bold-faced lie. Our unemployment rate is closer to 40%, again, independent verification. And because I ran three times for the job, you know, I can't complain about the challenges because obviously I ran to them. And so when you look at community restoration, it has to start with the community. It's not that police aren't important. They are. And like in Newark, our police and fire and EMS take up about 70% of our budget. Now, let's talk about budget for a minute, because it's important for you to understand that Indiana, in our infinite wisdom, passed constitutional property tax caps that cap residential property taxes at 1%. Commercial at 2%, industrial at 3%. And they did this back in 2009, and I should say we did it, because as a homeowner, it sounded like a great idea. And for 2009, 2010, 2011, there was a distressed unit appeals board that allowed communities that were disproportionately impacted by the property tax caps to get relief from the caps. On January 1st, 2012, the distressed unit appeals board went out of business, and Incidentally, that was my first day in office. It was a Sunday. Good thing I went to church. And what it meant in dollars and cents for us was that we lost half of our property tax base. And so on January 1st, 2012, we went from $40 million to $22 million in property tax revenue without any recourse. We do have revenue from casino gaming, but that's gone from $20 million in 2012 to just over $10 million today. And so when you look at police, fire, and EMS taking up over almost 70% of that budget, you know that there is a need to look at public safety or community restoration from a different perspective. And so 2 years ago, we initiated Gary for Life. And in many ways, it was based on a model that was developed in New Orleans, but we also added aspects that made it uniquely Gary. And so what does that mean? It means that we worked with the John Jay College and David Kennedy's organization to initiate the group violence intervention model so that we would not just go around randomly stopping and frisking or sweeping or looking at folks, but that we would target the folks who we know are involved in the most violent criminal activity. The good thing about being a professional vagabond is that you know a lot of the criminals by first name basis. They call me Freeman. I call them by their names. And we simply sent a message to these groups and said, they're not really gangs because now they're loosely associated. Maybe they grew up together. They may be related in some instances. So it's not the traditional gangs as we've known them. And the message was simply, we want you to take a different path in life. We'll provide those tools. In fact, we'll send you to the front of that line. But if you are not prepared or willing to take that path, then we'll send you to the front of the other line. And the tagline was, we'll help you if you let us. We'll stop you if you make us. And we began having call-ins, inviting those individuals who are on probation and parole, who we knew were most likely to be involved in criminal activity, and just suggesting to them that we knew what they were doing, that we were not willing to tolerate what had been an unacceptable murder rate. I was sitting with the mayor of Denver last week, and he said he had 50 murders in the city of Denver, and it was high. And I said I have 51 in Gary, and it was low. That's a problem. And so we communicated to these young men, and we've had four to date, that we were going to do everything in our power to assist them, but we were also going to do everything in our power, should they not accept the assistance, to stop them. And just to show you the requisite talent that exists in the city of Gary, and I would dare say communities across the country, as a result of one of the call-ins, a video was produced. And it was music in the background. And this guy provided his own take on the information that he saw in the call-in. And his message was simple. You guys need to stop. After this video, I'm disappearing because the police, the U.S. attorney, and the mayor are serious about this. So we know that the message is getting out. But it's not just focusing on the most violent offenders. It's increasing the number of block clubs and community watch groups. It is providing educational opportunities and out-of-school time opportunities to young men and women that allow them to aspire to things that will keep them from going down the wrong path. It's also providing job opportunities that are so essential. This year, the city of Gary has not been able to employ large numbers of young people in years. And so that we were not hampered by that, we said that we were going to appeal to local businesses and ask them to just take one young person during their summer program. Because employment opportunities matter. And then the cooperation among law enforcement. Those of you who have been involved in law enforcement, who know law enforcement, know that there is always a turf issue. Why are the state police here in the city? Why are other police departments in the city? And certainly there are concerns in terms of ensuring that they adhere to the same standard of interacting with the community as others, but we have developed a cooperation with law enforcement across genres that allow us to provide a greater level of safety in certain areas where that needs to happen. Two last things that we've done, we believe, to really enhance community involvement, community restoration. One is very similar to Occupy the Block. We call it the 5x5x5 initiative. And this actually developed out of a partnership that we entered into early on with the University of Chicago, where they introduced us to and suggested a program out of Savannah, Georgia, where we would go during the time between May and really November and take essential city services, code enforcement, demolition, general services cleanup, police, and take a 5-block radius in an area that had been identified as having a lot of criminal activity. And so we would work with the residents there to clean it up and get their buy-in that they would maintain the appearance of the residents. And during this 5-week period, I cut grass on Ryden Moor. But I cut grass in these areas because one of the side effects or one of the impacts of vacant and abandoned buildings is that you have blocks where residents are maintaining their homes in a pristine manner, but you have neighboring houses where the weeds are high or the grass is high that are really unkempt. And they're not owned by the city, but the expectation is that the city will do something about it. And we are, with state legislation, with local ordinances that are holding some of these property owners accountable. But many of them are speculators that are far outside the city of Gary. But with the 5x5x5 initiative, we have been able to provide a new look to neighborhoods that have been high crime. The last initiative has been an initiative that we call Bless the Block. About a year ago, members of the faith community came to me because we saw a surge in murder in June and July that was very disconcerting. And they said, we want to be helpful. And so they began an initiative where they would go out on Fridays and talk to residents. And we would simply walk communities talking to all of the residents about their concerns. The last thing I want to talk about is sort of this, the dichotomy that we face in our Gary for Life. Because the reality is that law-abiding citizens really don't care when you say you want to help violent offenders. In fact, on Monday we had a community forum, and residents, long-term residents, were there in number because one of their neighbors had been on her way inside and someone ran through their driveway shooting. And all they wanted to know is, what are you going to do about it? And they don't see the benefit of what I understand to be a long-term strategy as it relates to Gary for Life. And then the other aspect is really changing the attitude of law enforcement. Because again, they don't see the long-term benefit of really bringing all of the community services, opportunities, areas together. They believe, some of them, not all of them, believe that you can still arrest your way out of the problem. The good news for us is that our chief, our U.S. attorney, some of the other key law enforcement officials don't subscribe to this idea. Now, don't get me wrong. There are some people that belong in jail. I know them personally. But the overwhelming majority of folk, particularly those who are charged with nonviolent crime, need a different form of criminal justice. And it appears with the criminal justice reform legislation that we see at the federal level, with the leadership that the president is providing, with so much that has come not just out of the Black Lives Matter movement, but the Task Force on 21st Century Policing, that people are beginning to finally take a close look at what has been going on in our communities for a long, long time. And so, you know, we are honored to be a part of this, but I would say to you that attitude change is something that we, or behavior change is something that we can achieve in the short term, but attitude change and community restoration is really a long-term strategy.
Thank you both. I want to build on that last point you made, Ms. Mayor, about attitude change. And this may be coming from left field for you. As journalists covering the day-to-day of criminal justice nationally, in the wake of the Ferguson shooting and the unrest that followed, and particularly in Baltimore and the unrest that followed, police departments and criminal justice experts began to talk about something called the Ferguson effect, where there was this backlash where police felt they were so besieged and criticized and videotaped that they weren't getting out of their cars, that they weren't arresting people. And even the head of the FBI cited this, and I believe he backpedaled pretty quickly. And I'm wondering, in your own communities, whether this resonates for you at all, whether the headlines that we've been reading and writing have seeped into the community of Gary and the community of Newark, or has that just been an irrelevancy? Is there any such thing as a Ferguson effect?
I think it's completely ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Just to be frank, you know, I really think that that is like a kind of racist response to what's happening in these communities, and the failure of these folks to kind of live with or deal with what's actually happening has been happening for decades. I think police officers are trained, and when you're put in a situation, and a training is what's important. because the training in volatile situations, the training is what kicks in. And adrenaline, I think most police officers are going to do their job. If they ride up on something and they see something going on, they're going to get out the car, they're going to do what they're supposed to do, and their training will kick in. I don't see many police officers riding away and turning around and saying, I'm not going to, engage. I think what has happened, even in New York City, police officers may stop engaging people on simple and regular stops that they normally do, which kind of helped affect the stop and frisk, by the way. But it did not have any effect on the kind of reduction and advancement of crime in the city. And I think that that's the same thing all over the country. I don't see that being very real in my community, at least. I think police officers are going to respond. The majority and overwhelming majority are going to respond to issues that are dangerous, that are criminal, that are taking place. It's just their training, and they're going to do so. I don't see them doing anything other than that.
I agree with Mayor Baraka. The overwhelming majority of police officers in the city of Gary continued to do their jobs every day. Now, we had the benefit of being involved in the national initiative of building police and community trust, and John Jay is involved in that as well. But even beyond that, the only reason that you would be hesitant is if you're engaged in something that you shouldn't be engaged in, mm-hmm. and you don't want it captured. But, the president said something recently, and I think it's important. The greatest tool that law-abiding, right-thinking police officers have, and I would say that an overwhelming majority of them across the country are that, is to speak out against those folk that they know aren't doing the right thing, because those folks cast a shadow on the right-thinking and well-meaning mm-hmm. police officers.
I couldn't find in the clips. Were there any police shootings in either of your cities over the last year?
No.
No. None.
Okay. We'll open it up for some questions. Yes, miss?
Okay, we're going to pass the mics around, and please identify yourself, because it's on podcast. Can we get
we have mics?
Let's get McCarthy real quick. In the meantime, yes, just shout, and we'll get you.
From the beginning? Really? 90? Okay. Indiana, and I'm understanding a lot of states are in the midst of passing video laws that would make it almost impossible for people in the videos or the public, and especially journalists, to get access to dash cam or body camera videos. As people who are walking that fine line between representing your police and your residents and trying to get them to get along and, as you say, build trust between them. I mean, what do you think about these laws? What do you think about the cameras that obviously made such an effect in Chicago and in Ferguson?
I would say that, and I'm familiar with that legislation pending before the General Assembly in Indiana, that I do oppose it and have opposed it. I think that the whole point, and I always remind folks that body cameras, dash cams are simply a tool. And quite frankly, it's a tool after the fact, because it records this interaction. And if you develop trust prior to that interaction, then you're less likely to have something to record. But I think the best thing that you can do is make it available. And that's certainly true for the citizen, But I would suggest that it's also true for the officer, because you want people to see. Now, you know, does it cause second guessing from time to time? Sure, it does. But more often than not, it provides a window into what happened, and I think that's extremely important.
Thank you. Next question? Yes, in the back there.
There's a call on here?
Yes.
Hi, this question is for Mayor Baraka.
Identify yourself,
please. Stand up and identify yourself.
My name is David Ovalle. I'm a reporter with the Miami Herald. We've had a CIP, a civilian investigative panel, since 2002. It has subpoena power. It's rarely been used. It's widely considered not a very effective CIP. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the efforts and whether you guys are going to have subpoena power and what has gone into it and how you think it's going to operate and be a success.
So, ours does have subpoena power, and it also has investigatory authority as well. We have the Inspector General as my appointee on the board, who will be engaging in investigations, because civilians can't engage in investigation or look at police files, but the Inspector General can. We've created a matrix of discipline that is being used outside of the Civilian Police Review Board on all things that happen in the police department for the police trial board. So we're using a matrix that we created that has to be abided by at the Civilian Complaint Review Board. Now, since the review board can't discipline police officers, what we put in the ordinance is that they have to make a recommendation to the police director, who has to, follow the guidelines of what they said using the police matrix. If he disagrees with their finding, it has to be based on a clear error. And if he finds clear error, he has to come before the board and in writing write why he contradicted what their findings were, and speak before them and say that. So it's a very transparent and open process. But the idea that I think is strong is that there's some kind of matrix, so nobody can make up what they think the punishment should be. So if it's you get suspended, if it's that you lose your job, if you're degunned, it's all in the matrix. And the review board and the police director have to follow that matrix, which is in the ordinance. And if they don't, if the police director does not, it has to be because of clear error, and he has to put it in writing why. No, alongside, and that's where the debate is going to happen, because the guidelines is not clear on. Well, they're trying to say that you can't have a parallel organization in the first place. We disagree with that in the city, so we are setting up an organization that's parallel to internal affairs. So it's going to happen at the same time. And what people understand, if there's a criminal complaint, if they find something criminal, it has to go to the prosecutor's office anyway. And so the argument that they're making is a moot one, because ultimately, even the internal affairs, if they find something criminal, that also has to go to the prosecutor's office. So none of these groups can fine police anything that's criminal. All criminal activity has to be given to the prosecutor's office. Most of the things that are reviewed by either one of those boards are infractions that the police or the civilians think are infractions that can maybe cause them to lose their job, be suspended, be degunned, but not put in jail, right? And that's very clear.
We've had a fight with the RCIP has had subpoena, like on an active police shooting investigation, and it actually needs a court to quash their subpoena, and the state attorney hasn't finished their investigation yet.
Is that going to be something where some of that information will become public, or will it be shielded until the state finishes their investigation?
Well, that's always going to be the case.
Yeah.
And that's with anybody, not just police officers. If there's a case going on, they're not going to divulge the information. And, that's with anybody. So once it gets in the hands of the prosecutor's office and they're doing a criminal investigation, then all of our investigation has to stop until the criminal investigation finishes. Right.
Next question.
Hi, my name is Amy Radel. I'm with KUOW. It's public radio in Seattle. And I just would like to ask both of you about your relationship with the police guilds in your community. And I've heard about what's happening in Newark, and I just wondered, how did you make that happen? Did that have to be bargained, you know, as a change to workplace conditions, this new civilian oversight that you've put in place? Or how have you made the changes happen that you have accomplished?
Well, we just did it. That's what the police union is arguing, that it has to be a collective bargaining kind of discussion, because it changes the rules and regulations of what's happening in the police force. And we argue that it does not, that the matrix that we've created actually involves the police union and the Superior Officers Association to be involved in actually creating the discipline matrix to determine how police officers are disciplined, not just at the review board, but in any trial board that the police may have to go through in any infraction that they have, whether they're brought up on charges by a captain or a lieutenant or any of their superior officers for that matter. So this is consistent with the trial board hearing, as well as the review board, as well as the internal affairs. So it's even and consistent across the board. So we don't believe that we have to have any kind of dialogue with them around negotiations.
I remember being a new mayor and someone giving me the advice that, you know, you never be able to please police officers. They always hate you. And I was naive because, of course, I had gotten the endorsement of the FOP, and as a longtime public defender, had, you know, developed a rapport with many of the officers, particularly in the Gary Police Department. And then a year ago, I had my State of the City address, and they were protesting outside. So I guess the person at least had some element of truth. But my relationship has been to really try to communicate with them our challenges. The greatest concern that they've expressed is around their compensation. They make about $10,000, $10,000 to $12,000 less than neighboring cities. And it is all a function of the budget. And so they were always of the impression the money has to be there. They're just spending on other things. And finally, I just sat down with them and said, okay, let's do the math. And went through and showed them every source and use of revenue that we had. And they began to understand. Now, of course, we did together work to develop a way to provide raises, about $10,000 over a 3-year period. And one of those ways was that we had to look at using public safety officers. And that's something that they were skeptical about, but they understood we had to look at law enforcement a different way. I'm really interested in what has transpired in Newark, because I think that ultimately we'll have to go to all public safety officers.
Do you have a similar salary disparity in Newark versus the suburbs for law enforcement?
No. I think the police officers in Newark made a comparable amount of money. Given the amount of work they have to do, that's a different kind of thing. I mean, if you compare the amount of work they had to do based on what their counterparts have to do in other cities,
they're busier.
They're a lot busier. Mm-hmm. So as a matter of fact, some of them have to wind up solving cases in other people's communities as well as ours. So, you know, the kind of pay that they get might not be commensurate to the job that they actually have to do. I mean, that's clear to me. Mm-hmm. But with dwindling resources, as the mayor said, it is difficult for us to continuously to give them everything that they want and need and run the city at the same time, particularly since they have not agreed to live in the city. So that income could actually go back into our community to help feed them. It's kind of counterintuitive for them to move out and ask for more money.
Roughly what percentage of police and fire employees live in your cities?
So for us, it's about 30% of fire. It's a little higher with police, more 40 to 45. Mm-hmm. We have a similar law, but it's actually a state statute that says that police and fire do not have to live in the communities that they work in. They can live in any contiguous county. So that really does create an issue. But we do have a policy you can have a take-home car if you live in the community as a police officer. And there's actually an ordinance that limits the rank that you can achieve if you don't live in the community as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I might steal that. you have to live in Newark for a year while you're getting the job. So that's in the academy.
Hmm.
Right. Okay. Once you get out of the academy, you can go where you want to go. Mm-hmm. And you know that there are people who have addresses in the city.
Sure.
And, you know, they do that for the whole year. They put a coat on a hanger and stick it in the closet. And they pass the investigation and they become an officer.
Right. Okay. Next question.
This is just a follow-up to the last question.
Tell us who you are.
My name's Beth Schwartz-Eppel. I'm with the Marshall Project. This is related to the issue of the pushback from the police officers union. When you were talking about that earlier, what immediately came to mind is that officers' funeral here in New York last year, where the entire police union stood and put their backs to Mayor de Blasio. And I wondered what kind of position, I'm not assuming you have that level of tension, but it must put you in a really difficult position as far as maintaining credibility as a leader in that city. And even the leaders that you chose in the police department must struggle with maintaining credibility as a leader of that department, given that kind of tension. I was just wondering how you manage that.
I don't think no place is like New York City. Let me just say that first. But to that level. But that's absolutely correct. I think that it is a tightrope that most leadership have to walk, trying to appease the administration or the mayor and the staff and the rank and file of the police department at the same time. That there are places where we separate. And it's a very difficult thing to do. Ultimately, I think part of the problem with most of these unions, the police unions, is that a lot of retired police officers still have incredible amounts of influence and impact on the union itself. So a lot of the members that are in the union day to day that are dealing with what's going on, sometimes they have a smaller voice in the policies and the direction of the union. I would believe that retired officers have more time on their hands to get themselves involved in that. Some of them, in some of these places, they can still vote in these elections. They still can participate. They still affect whether we're talking about salary increases. When police officers leave, the amount of money cities have to give officers when they separate from the city, all of those things are still involved in that. And unfortunately, a lot of these retired officers, a lot of them still harbor those old kind of feelings and ideas that were 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago are still there. They still kind of permeate the culture of the department that is mostly racist, mostly white male, mostly aggressive towards the community, and they still hold these sentiments and those sentiments through the leadership of the department, which is mostly white men throughout this country, begin to continue to enforce and allow to go on. So the culture of the police department has to be changed, and it's changed through training, and I think it happens through young officers that are coming in, and then there has to be something that begins to separate some of these guys who have retired from the force away from the policy of how the union is being run day to day.
It's certainly a balance that we have to maintain, that our chief has to maintain. That balance was really challenged 2 years ago. We lost an officer, and he was working on the midnight shift, and the shift was understaffed. And, of course, there was a large degree of animosity towards me, towards the chief, because of the fact that the shift was understaffed and this officer was killed in his car. At the same time, I find that when you look at who the FOP represents, who's involved actively in the union, I agree with Mayor Baraka that it's not the majority of active officers. And, the way that we've been able to achieve that balance is through communication and through acknowledging when there is a problem. I mean, there's no reason that that shift, that midnight shift, should have been understaffed. And so we understand that, and it's always important to acknowledge when you're wrong. And I think that it's not just with law enforcement, it's within any area of governing as a mayor. I have to acknowledge, you know, that was wrong. And I think when you do, then people understand that at least there's a desire to communicate and to be transparent, and I think that goes a long way.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Oh, this is Gary Craig with the Democrat and Chronicle in Rochester, New York. This is for Mayor Freeman Wilson. If I understood correctly, you said that some of the kind of perpetual troublemakers did take you up, took the city up on offers for assistance. Things you could do. What in particular was done for them?
They have. And so we've provided employment opportunity. We've provided changes relative to their housing. Some have even enrolled in educational programs. It's still early. The numbers are still small. But what we understand is that, you know, everyone is not a leader in those groups. And so when we are able to get the attention of the leaders, of the main actors, then a lot of people follow, even though they may not be formally involved in the program.
Show of hands. Yes, sir.
Let's get a fellow first, and then we'll go to Professor Richard here, and then Ernie, if that's okay.
Sure.
Hi, I'm Maurice Shema from the Marshall Project. I was just curious to hear more about civilian comp stat. That sounds like a great story that someone should do. And I'm curious what has come out of that, what sorts of community members show up to those meetings, what those discussions are like, that sort of thing.
So right now what is happening is there's a we've invited a few individuals to comp stat as it is already, beginning to bring people in. What we're going to do is begin to have them in places of worship around the city, which are people are more are comfortable with coming into. And we're going to do the actual CompStat, probably not with all of the detailed information, but allow people to see how it functions and allow the community to begin to ask questions about it. So we've been talking to many people around the community about it and getting them ready and bringing individuals in. In fact, there's CompStat today, and there are a few people going to this morning's CompStat to see how it is run. So individuals who are quote-unquote leadership, community leaders in the neighborhood, so they could see it. So they could see that there's some kind of plan to the policing, and it's just not arbitrary, and we're just not out there trying to attack everybody that we see, that there's some specific theory to what's happening out here. And I think that last night we talked about it, was a lot of excitement came about in terms of people saying that they want to be a part of it, they want to see it. So I look forward to the kind of results of it.
I'm Rick Rosenfeld from the University of Missouri, St. Louis. I was intrigued by Mayor Freeman Wilson's comment, and I hope you would be willing to elaborate on it, developing a core of public safety officers, presumably from the ranks of police officers and firefighters. And I think that is likely to generate a lot of support in the community. There's excess capacity on the firefighter side, and I think more and more community members grow concerned when they perceive that fire trucks are often more likely to be chasing heart attacks than fires. So as the number of fires have plummeted, we've got excess capacity on the firefighter side. And on the police side, in cities like Newark, Gary, my own city of St. Louis, we certainly need more personnel. So here's my question. In Gary, have you begun to provide firefighters with the training and perhaps some of them with the incentives to perform broader public safety functions?
So our experience in the city of Gary, and this is largely attributable to the fact that we have about 6,500 vacant and abandoned buildings, is that firefighters are not, they don't have a lot of time on their hands. Despite the conventional wisdom of police officers, I was witness to bantering back and forth, and of course it's always, you know, you sleep all the time, you get to eat at work, but our firefighters are pretty active both on the fire side as well as the EMS side, because we have combined firefighters and EMT, EMS services. At the same time, there is a value, and we've seen it, to not only training firefighters in some of the less involved law enforcement activity, but training police officers in some of the less involved fire activities. So what we contemplate doing, and we're just finalizing the details of this with the unions, is that there will be people who will be primarily firefighters and primarily police officers, but they will have training in some of the less involved activity of the other profession, and it will allow us to hire public people as public safety officers, and it will mean that we won't have to hire as many. And so right now, our police and fire are staffed roughly at about 230 officers. But if we are able to get a combination of 50, then we won't have to staff as many, and so it won't cost as much. And ultimately, we'll be able to provide that cost saving as savings as raises to the existing officers.
I guess this gentleman's next. Here, please.
Hi, I'm Ernie Drucker. I'm a research professor here at John Jay, and I come out of a background in public health. I've been working recently with the city of York, Pennsylvania, around development of harm reduction programs around drug use. You know, we're all facing this tremendous heroin resurgence, and it has implications for overdose deaths. You know, we're getting up to 30, 40,000 overdose deaths a year in this country, which is more than guns, more than autos. There's a role for police in this around the use of Narcan. And in York, after 5 years of struggle around opening a needle exchange program, the police got involved in a Narcan distribution program. I don't know if you have that in Newark or in Gary, but it turns out to be a real bridge to opening up a public service role for police doing something that they can be very proud of and people appreciate. So in the first 6 months in Kent, in York, Pennsylvania, they saved 100 lives. And that's a real signal achievement. And this is happening all of a sudden. Do you have these Narcan programs in Newark or Gary yet? That's that antidote that saves
people. Can you explain the Narcan program?
So Narcan program is, with the police specifically, is that the police being first responders around many, many events, including among them overdose events, which were formerly a place of great contention because the police went there as a crime scene. Who'd you get the drugs from? And people didn't call police, so more people died because of that. So the response time changes dramatically once you open up police to being the first responders who will help you with the overdose situation with this magic drug, Narcan. And it works on the ground. It changes the attitude about policing in the communities where it happens. In the case of York, it led to approval of opening this syringe exchange program with the sponsorship of the prosecutor, the county prosecutor, the police chief, and most importantly, the coroner, because the coroner was tracking these overdose deaths and reported those, and that's often in many cities like Vancouver, Canada, what got things launched, the recognition of how many people were dying from it. So is any of that happening in your places?
No. We don't... We'd have a rough time getting a needle exchange passed in the state of New Jersey. We're nowhere near where that is. And I think that the level of the priority in terms of overdose and homicide and other things is different in various communities. I don't think that the level of overdose is as high in our community like that to be able to. Get the community to say that this is the direction that we need to go in. I think most of the issues are drug exchange and you know, selling back and forth. For most of the people that are buying the drugs, you know, there are some overdoses, but probably for the most part, they're doing a different drug now and they're overdosing from either the K2, the sniffing, the other kind of things. The pharmaceutical drugs at the same time. So it's a little different in the city of Newark.
we've not seen the level of overdoses that they've seen in suburban communities around Gary, but I do support and have asked our chief to look at making Narcan available, because we have seen a few overdoses, and if there's an opportunity to stem one, then I think it makes sense. We have had an epidemic in the state of Indiana, particularly in some of our rural counties in the South, and actually led to an AIDS epidemic, but the needle exchange issue has been a problem, although I support it, given my experience with drug treatment.
How prevalent, if at all, is heroin in your cities?
Not at all.
Well, yeah. Heroin is still prevalent in our community, but you know, sometimes people take it other ways instead of intravenously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have bags, they sniff it, they do all kinds of other things. So,
mm-hmm.
We're seeing a high incidence of synthetic marijuana that is very dangerous. Mm-hmm. Certainly not right. as dangerous as heroin, but mm-hmm. It's been a problem.
And how much of the crime or street crime in your cities would you characterize as drug related?
Probably a overwhelming majority of it is drug-related and personal disputes. If you're talking about violence and homicide, it's personal disputes. See, in corporate America, you know, they have tort law and, you know, all these other things. If somebody owe you some money, you can take them to court, you know, and get your money back. If somebody's wronged you, you can go into the court mm-hmm. of law, but in the street, there is no court of law. The court of law is aggressiveness and guns, and if somebody owes you money, you shoot them. And ultimately, that's exactly what's happening with these drug disputes. They turn into that. So a lot of people turn this stuff into, like, gang disputes, which is, like, romantic and is good for the History Channel or stuff like that. If people watch this stuff, gangland.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not really what's going on. What's happening is that, you know, people are have turned the whole economy, underworld economy, with drug activity, the same way alcohol was during Prohibition, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're going back and forth at each other, and the way they settle disputes is with violence and guns, and that's what's happening.
And what's the most common drug that is transacted right now in Newark or Gary?
I would say heroin and, you know, still cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, now we have these pills, like these pharmaceutical drugs that, mm-hmm. that people are taking, you know, pain medications, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I would say cocaine and marijuana, but probably 70% of our crime is related to drugs and the drug trade. The other, and that is violent crime. But we have seen, we've had 6 homicides this year. And they have been equally divided between those related to drugs and domestic violence. And so we are extremely concerned about an upsurge in particularly homicides related to domestic violence.
So just to follow up, you would support changes in federal or state legislation in terms of how we're now enforcing the drug war, whether it's legalization of marijuana all the way up to changes in sentencing?
So I support the changes in sentencing. I believe that the disparity, particularly between crack and powder cocaine and the incarceration for nonviolent offenses is a problem. I do not support legalization. So I put on my treatment hat.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that marijuana, particularly this type of marijuana as we see it now, is a gateway drug. I don't think that it you know, when you talk about the medicinal use or the personal recreation use, I just don't think that that's something we need to open up for our young people. And ultimately, if you do it for adults, it will go towards, it will become available for young people. But certainly when you look at the sentencing, that is a clear problem.
Well, I, just the way in, I definitely support, you know, the sentence changing, and I support legalization in some areas as well. I think that, you know, there are drugs that are legal that are more dangerous than drugs that are illegal, right? And so it becomes a societal question about what drugs are being legalized and which ones are not, and for what purpose. Like, which part of the demographic is taking that drug or using that drug, and are we criminalizing that demographic based on the drug that they're using, right, or taking? And I think that we need to have a real serious discussion as a nation about drugs that are legal and illegal. And the reason I say that, there are a lot of pharmaceutical drugs now that kids are taking, that people are taking, that are legal drugs that are being sold illegally on the street, and are causing all kinds of issues for us in the city of Newark. By the way, that they use these scripts, that prescriptions that they call scripts, that they go and get mm-hmm. and get these legal drugs, from cough syrup, with codeine in it, to promethazine, mm-hmm. and all of these kinds of drugs, right? So all of those things have been causing huge problems for us in the city of Newark. So we have to have a real discussion about this, all moral things aside, and figure out what's affecting our nation. And are we legalizing drugs or making drugs illegal based on who's using that or not, and have a discussion, a real justice kind of discussion about that.
Yeah. Next question.
Hey, I'm Sinjin from the Houston Chronicle. I was just really interested in, Mayor Freeman Wilson, about your comments about public safety officers. Are there any other cities that you're aware of that are doing that? I've never even heard of that collaboration.
Yes,
integration.
Newark is doing it. Benton Harbor, Michigan. There are some communities in North Carolina. So, yes, there is a small movement. I won't say it's a mass movement towards public safety officers because, again, firefighters, police officers are territorial. But there are some communities, even in the state of Indiana, that are doing it.
So, like in Newark, for example, we have a public safety department. We just organized. We have one public safety director that's in charge of police, fire, and EMS, together with a public safety director and deputy director. So fire and police actually work together. What we're getting ready to do is change the communications department, where when people call, they only call one place for police and fire. So they'll be calling whoever they call for, fire, police, it'll go to one place. We're going to start getting fire department folks to respond to things that are non-emergency or non-criminal kind of things. If a person is, having a heart attack, or if a person is, they think there's some suspicion around their house, the lights went out. People call police for all kinds of incidents, right? And sometimes the police go there, sometimes they can't. But a fire official can go to a scene because they're freed up. If somebody's in here choking to death, or something is going on, there's a fight or whatever it is, that we're going to be able to begin ready to respond, make fire department folks respond to.
Next question.
Good morning. Tim Igo, Arizona Attorney Magazine. You know, a stakeholder who's kind of hovering beneath a lot of what you talked about this morning are state legislators, who either don't understand or actively dislike cities. So I'm wondering
That's a good point.
How you advocate? Actively. How do you advocate yeah. in Trenton and Indianapolis for your city? And if you were put on a spot and could change one state law next year that would help your city, whether it's tax code or criminal law, what would it be?
Well, our state delegation. Is pretty good, I might add. I meet with those guys regularly and ladies about laws that we need and policy. Unfortunately, most of the things that we've agreed upon and got through the legislature has been vetoed by our good friend, the governor. I can't say that they have not been supportive or helpful. And I wish I could name one, because there's so much that we need in our city. One from the Port Authority, that's number one, which is a serious issue for us in the city of Newark. The one I just told you about earlier, where we're trying to get our public officials to actually live in the city where they are for at least 5 or more years. That's a law that we tried to get passed. It got vetoed. The land banking, those two things. So I would say the police and land banking, that was also vetoed, would allow us to do something creative and tremendous with all of the vacant land and property and foreclosed things that we have in our city. They have it in Detroit. They've been doing great work in Detroit with property that they've been able to land bank and, you know, redevelop. We need that in New Jersey. Our governor doesn't think so. Maybe some of you know him, and you can call him to help us out.
Mayor?
We have a an interesting relationship with the Indiana General Assembly. Some of you may know, certainly my fellow Hoosier knows, that there is a supermajority in both houses of Republicans, or both chambers of Republicans. And as a Democratic mayor, one might think that the pickings would be slim for me. But we've had a level of success, certainly not as much success if there were other circumstances, but we have had a level of success in making a case in many areas. The area that we've been really challenged in is with the property taxes and with the gun laws in Indiana, which not only have an impact on Gary, but have an impact on neighboring communities. Last year, our General Assembly took it upon themselves to impact a lawsuit. In fact, one of the last lawsuits in the country against gun manufacturers and gun dealers that was pending. It was the city of Gary versus these manufacturers and dealers, and it was pending in state court, and they passed a law that they thought would dismiss this lawsuit, you know, unheard of, and if you think about the separation of powers. But for the most part, we have gone to them with legislation, and they have been supportive, particularly around vacant and abandoned property, around our efforts to revitalize our airport, our work with the Regional Development Authority. But it's been a challenge, to say the least.
Can I follow up on that? I can't let you guys go without addressing one of the central themes of our symposium this week, and the elephant in the room, which is the election campaign that's going on now. I mean, there are a lot of folks who, in the criminal justice field, who are relieved that politics, that criminal justice has been out of politics for the last 10 or 15 years, because they're always afraid that as soon as it enters, you begin to get the tough-on-crime rhetoric, and then things get just worse from there. But it's back on the scene now, for whatever reason. We've seen it in local campaigns. We've seen it in the federal campaign. And I wonder if, from your point of view, without taking any partisan approach, that what you'd like our current presidential candidates or our not candidates for the nomination would like to say or do, and what you wouldn't like to see them say or do if they become president, or if they get to the stage where they're facing off against each other.
Good grief. So I'm trying to get a handle on the question itself. So it depends on which one of those guys and people you're talking about, right? So,
but in general, without making a reference to me, what you'd like them to say or not say at this stage about the criminal justice challenges you're facing at your level from your perspective?
Well, honestly, I think a lot of the things are being said. And it could go further than I think whether people believe that, Senator Sanders can win or anything like that. But I do believe him being in the race has brought so many issues out front and pushed this debate further and further to the left. And I think it's important that actually takes place. And a lot of the issues are being brought out around criminal justice reform, around mass incarceration, around police misconduct, even around unemployment and education. These issues are being brought out and being talked about. We're talking about things that hadn't been talked about since post-World War II, right? So they're talking about things that were put in place during FDR that people are trying to attack, and the expansion of it, whether you're talking about breaking up banks or all these kinds of things. I think these discussions are incredibly necessary, particularly for cities where we are that never, ever experienced any of this stuff that they're talking about. So we never had a new deal. We didn't have an old deal. So the new deal never made its way to Newark. We didn't get the Marshall Plan that went to Europe. It didn't even come to us. So most of these things that they're talking about affect us directly. And I like them to continue to have these discussions. And, you know, I've been advocating for an urban Marshall Plan for the last 2 or 3 years that I think absolutely needs to take place, a serious investment in these in communities like Cleveland, communities like Gary, communities like Newark, you know, that need a shot in the arm around job creation, job development, public works projects, job training. All of those things are necessary. The same way they pulled hundreds and thousands of Americans out of poverty, the same thing needs to happen in these cities. And I think that will affect the entire country and not just the cities where we are.
The thing that I want them to remember and those conversations around, you know, so many of the issues that are concerning us all in criminal justice, whether you're talking about sensible gun laws or sentencing reform, those mental health issues as it relates to the criminal justice arena, those conversations are occurring. I think it's important for them to understand that it does not, criminal justice issues don't occur in a vacuum. That when you talk about housing,
yep,
when you talk about employment, when you talk about the environment, all of those have implications in the criminal justice arena. When you talk about education, they all have implications. And so if the conversation, if I were guiding the conversation, I would always guide it away from law enforcement, not because they're not important, but guide it to the importance of the community's involvement.
Right. We have time for, I have a question for the of the future, building on Steve's question. There's a new book that's just come out called Evicted by a social scientist called named Matthew Desmond, which looks at the community of city of Milwaukee and the intersection of poverty and housing and eviction. And it's an amazing book. I'm in the middle of it. And it really, in some ways, people have noted it's really the flip side of mass incarceration. And that the experience, disinvestment in housing nationally, especially in our cities, which you both just alluded to, creates a sociology intersecting more female related, right, just as mass incarceration is more male related. And I'm wondering if we can get high-minded, whether we can just talk to things like housing and the sociology of housing in your own cities and how it does intersect with crime, criminal justice, poverty, et cetera. Because as Mayor Freeman Wilson just said, we can't look at any one of these issues in a vacuum. But it seems that housing, since the end of federal subsidies in the last 30 years, has,
right,
become more and more expensive and more rare in cities for the poor. And so if you could just speak to that and how it does maybe relate to crime, family, fragmentation, things like that. Because I suspect just as mass incarceration is being talked about a lot today, in the next few years we're going to be hearing a lot more about housing and evictions and the problems of affordable housing in cities. That's my guess.
In Newark, there's about 20,000 people on a housing waiting list.
Mm-hmm.
And there's about the same amount who are waiting to be transferred from one place of living to another because their family has outgrown the place that they're in now.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking maybe about 40,000 people who are looking for a place to live that we have knowledge of.
Mm-hmm.
And these are not the people that are qualified as homeless, though they are. When incarceration is directly related to that, because a lot of the men or the males that are incarcerated leave the women and their families behind, who invariably make less money than men in the first place, because we still haven't abided by Lilly Ledbetter anyway. So you still have women who are making considerably less amount of money, but trying to take care of kids in an economy that's becoming more expensive for them to navigate in. Housing costs are rising, the cost of living is increasing, and they're there trying to raise children in an environment like that, who and it becomes increasingly difficult for them. And a lot of these guys that you see that are involved in these crimes and things that you see come up in households like that. So it's almost a vicious cycle that takes place, right? So when there's not decent and quality housing and stabilized neighborhoods, these things begin to affect how people are being raised, how they're being brought up in that environment. And again, the more likelihood it is for them to get involved in street-level activity, to find money, whether it's petty robbery or theft that then graduates to drug activity, that graduates into to violence and murder and or being victims of murder. I think all of that is related to each other. That's why it's important for us, and I think the strategy has been to give people these vouchers, and they take these vouchers out to these kind of suburban towns or outskirts of the city, and they begin to live out there in those towns and begin to go back and forth, which continues to also destabilize these families and these communities, because there is no more investment. What they found out is that the housing that they invested in didn't work. You know, what they did was begin to build these big projects and concentrate poverty and people in these projects with no job development, no creation, no health care, nothing, and left them there. Mm-hmm. And when they deteriorated, they broke them down and created scattered site housing and put the people all over the place. Then they've decided that also wasn't something that they wanted to do. So now they want to destroy scattered site housing and give people vouchers to allow them to move around where they want, you know, which is this kind of marketplace idea, which became more popular under the whole Reagan era and moving forward, right? So none of it has actually helped us in our cities provide decent housing for people, find opportunities for them to have employment. And I think all of it is, the unifying piece of all of that is poverty. And I think whether we're talking about employment or housing or crime or any of those things, that we have to, it all meets back to poverty, and we have to have that discussion about income inequality, about economic inequality, about poverty, about what King talked about in the last days of his life, the two Americas or the other America. I mean, people like to talk about King in 1963 and the March on Washington, but they don't talk about King said that there needs to be a guaranteed income for every American in this country. It makes him sound a little bit like Bernie Sanders, but that's exactly what he said, you know, to deal with the issues that we have.
You know, our experience with affordable housing has been a little different in that we have seen and had probably over the last 7 to 10 years a number of projects that were renovations, that were new affordable housing projects that has really provided quality housing both in regards to the Gary Housing Authority and outside, largely outside of the Gary Housing Authority. We are in a CEA, Cooperative Endeavor Agreement, currently with HUD, where our housing authority is undergoing some significant renovations, largely because of the deterioration of the housing stock. So that there are improvements there. But one of the challenges that we have had, and it's closely related to what Mayor Baraka talked about, is the ability to provide education, to provide employment opportunities to those individuals who live in affordable housing, to stem crime. And what is happening for us is that there's this dissension that's almost occurring between those who live in affordable housing and those individuals that I refer to as legacy residents of the city of Gary. And so if you live near one of these apartment complexes where there is a lot of affordable housing and you see criminal activity and you believe it impacts you, then you become very hostile towards this population. And people regularly say to me, we don't need one more affordable housing development. And I understand what they're saying, but I can't totally embrace it because people absolutely need affordable housing, but we need to really pay attention to what's going on. I just 2 days ago had an opportunity to talk to the new manager at a project that occurred, and it opened right after I took office. That was a beautiful project. In fact, I had an aunt who lived there. And now it has deteriorated, not the appearance of the property, but the behavior of the tenants. And I said to her, I said, that's like the Carter, the housing in New Jack City. So I said, you know, we've got to do something about that, and we'll work with you to improve it. And she certainly embraced that opportunity. So I think it's how do you support those individuals who live in affordable housing, who are feeling the impact of poverty? How do you help them to increase their quality of life, their standard of living, so that it ultimately impacts how the city looks?
Thank you. I think we have time for one last question.
Hi, my name is Ross Tuttle. I'm an independent journalist and documentary producer. I live in Brooklyn. My frame of reference, therefore, is New York City, and I understand that mayors are often under pressure to expand their police forces, and therefore it seems that the role of the police also expands. And even when violent crime seems to be going down, which also may increase the number of misdemeanors that are issued, which we know fall disproportionately on minorities. I also understand that that's an economic engine, at least for New York City, you know, those summonses and the money coming in. And I just wonder what kind of pressures you guys are under to expand your police forces and the role of the police when some critics of that expansion are also calling for the reduction in the jobs and the tasks that police forces are asked to carry out and maybe to kind of distribute those resources elsewhere.
Right. So I would agree with that, but I think in Newark we have a different situation. A few years ago, the former mayor laid off about 100 and some police officers, and they hadn't hired a police officer since 2010. And so the, you know, when police officers were not hired, when people retired, kind of diminished the force and weakened the force. So it was important for us to begin to set in a put together a strategy where we begin to bring more police officers on board, and that's what we're working to do. So we have to expand our police force as a matter of necessity. We almost cut in half the number of police officers we actually have in our community. What that number should be in terms of a workable number is something that we're still discussing administratively, meaning what number do we want to get at where we can finally say this is enough for us to have the police force that we need is important. I also believe that we need to begin to use money in other areas because obviously there has been or the effect of arrest or incarceration and a reduction of crime has had a diminishing effect at this point. So we're arresting more people or incarcerating more people, but violent crime is not being reduced largely over the nation because of the more arrests. So I think there are other things that actually need to happen. NVRI is one of the strategies that the mayor talked about. We call it that in the city of Newark, where we do call-ins or Newark Community Street Team, which is opportunities for folks to get hired, residents to get hired, to go out in the community, help solve disputes that are happening in the community, safe passageway to school. We have put in a program in Newark now where we, after we hire 25 police officers through the police budget, we're going to hire a social worker for every 25 cops that we hire. We're going to hire a social worker to be involved in arrest and precinct activity of young folks between 16 and 24 and try to help steer them on a different way besides continuing down a path of crime. So I believe that a lot of the resources that police officers have or the police department has can be used for the greater good of the community and not just continuously hiring more and more and more police officers. And we have to, if we look at crime or violence as public health, it makes sense to begin to use police budgets to add other elements to how you begin to target or fix crime in your community and use it under police and health together. And that's exactly what we've been trying to do in the city of Newark. But you have to understand the culture of what's happening. So, and I tried to speak about it a little earlier. Like in the city, when people don't see police officers, they think that something is wrong, right? And they kind of put pressure on the elected officials for police officers to be present because people associate police officers with security and protection, but at the same time with violence. So, I mean, that we have to deal with that. In other communities, when people see the police, they think that something is wrong when they see the police, and they associate security and safety with the quality of their home, the quality of their neighborhood, the quality of their job, the quality of their school, right? And that is not happening in our community, so we have a lot of work to do socially to begin to fix the physical outcomes of what's happening in our city and our community, but at the same time, the way people perceive safety and security.
Last word, Mayor Freeman Wilson.
I've constantly, and over the last really year and a half, challenged our chief and his command staff, as well as residents, to look at the number of police that we have in a different way. We lost a lot of officers over the last year because of salary disparities. And what I said to them is this really the best way, very similar to what Mayor Barack has just said, to spend our money? Are there other ways that we can spend our resources, particularly when you look at nearly 70% of our resources going towards public safety? And we are still working to achieve the right number, but in looking at that right number, it's a realization that if you double the police force, you're not going to stop crime because you're not going to be present every place in the community. And that's where citizens come in. And so that's really been my emphasis. Yes, we need police. Yes, we want them in our community. But the solution is not more officers. It's more community involvement.
Well, thank you both, Mayors Baraka and Freeman Wilson. This was really enlightening. Learned a lot. I learned a lot. And thank you to the audience. Really contributed.
And I want to add thank you also to Neil for facilitating a great conversation. We're going to take a 10-minute break or so. It's 15 minutes on your programs, but we'll shorten it so we can get on to our next program. And thanks again to everybody.
Thank you, man. Sure. Absolutely.